How many people in here have either read the book or attended one of the other talks that I gave? So, the reason I'm asking, I want to try to figure out how much of, you know, I have to go over the old stuff and how much I can get to the new stuff. But it looks like most everyone knows. Who has not read the book or attended the talk? So I'll give a brief rundown for you guys. Which book did someone say? Holographic Universe. This book.
Is that the most recent?
Yeah. And if you could pass those, everyone take one. Oh, bless you, aren't you kind? Thank you very much.
They didn't take the hint.
I know they didn't, did they? Okay, I'm Michael Talbot, as I'm sure all of you have figured out by now. And for those of you who don't know what the holographic idea is, let me just give a brief rundown of it. What I really want to talk about today are some of the practical applications of the holographic idea, because it's got some fascinating information with all kinds of implications, but I don't think that they're valuable unless we can sort of bring them into our everyday life and use them in some way, and that's really something that's very important to me. And when I wrote this book, that wasn't the focus. So I'm really, when I give talks, it always is part of the focus, the practical information, how we can sort of incorporate it into what we do. And so I've realized that I'm probably going to have to write another book that gives some of this information, but that's what I'm going to talk about today. The holographic idea is an idea that was created in tandem by two men working separately, a physicist named David Bohm, who's a former protege of Einstein's, and a neurophysiologist named Carl Pribram. And briefly, Pribram discovered, for example, that the brain uses the same mathematics to decipher perception as involved in the making of a hologram. And a hologram is a three-dimensional image made with the aid of a laser light. Bohm, in studying subatomic reality, discovered that there are properties on the subatomic level that suggest that the very fabric of reality is put together like a hologram. If you put these two ideas together, that our brains are programmed to decipher something holographic and reality is structured like a hologram, it suggests that maybe reality is a kind of giant hologram. Not that it's made out of, you know, laser light, but that it's more of a construct than the sort of sticks and stones world that we were taught about in high school science class. Now, there are three broad areas where this has implications, the idea that reality is kind of a hologram, and I'll touch upon the first one only briefly, although I think it's very important, but it's not going to be the focus of this talk. And the first one has to do with the interconnectedness of all things. And it involves a very special quality that holograms have. If you take a piece of photographic film that has a holographic image encoded in it, that means when you look at it with your naked eye, you're just going to see a blur. You have to shine a laser light through it to reconstruct a three-dimensional image. So say the film has an image of a rose encoded in it. You shine a laser light through it, and you get what looks like a three-dimensional image of the rose. Now, the interesting thing about a hologram is if you cut it in half, this piece of film, and shine a laser through each piece, you don't get half a rose out of each piece. You still get an entire rose. You cut it in four, you get four roses. You cut it in eight, you get eight roses. As I've said in some of my other talks, if you can just forgive me for repeating myself for the benefit of the people that haven't heard this, I always liken this to watching television. That, you know, when you watch a TV show, say you're watching Johnny Carson on your television set, you know that the image on your TV set that is one form that the information is in, that is in that TV signal, and you know that picture comes from the radio waves that permeate the room that your TV set is in. But you wouldn't say, where in the room is Johnny Carson's face? or where is Johnny Carson? Because you know that wherever you put the TV set, you're going to tune into the entire image. And that's what a hologram is, like. Wherever you take the hologram, the piece of photographic film, and look for the image, you're going to find it. And we also have other examples of this in that biological life seems to be like this also. You know, if you have an embryo at a certain stage of development and divide it in half, you don't get half a child in each piece. You get identical twins because each piece contains the whole in some strange sense. The same is true of a magnet. I don't know if any of you have seen the demonstration of, you know, where you put a bar magnet under a piece of paper and sprinkle iron filings on top, and you have a north end and a south end. When you break that magnet in half, you don't have just a piece with just one end, a north end. Then each piece still has a north south, and you can see the magnetic field and the filings, the way that it forms. And around the single bar magnet forms in a sort of oval, but you break it in half and then it forms into two smaller ovals, each around each bar magnet. So again, these are all examples of things that are kind of organized in this holographic way, where the whole is contained in every part of what we look at. Now, when I say interconnectedness, the reason that this suggests that things are interconnected is because it means that, quite literally, if the universe is a hologram, that you can find the universe in every piece of itself, that every part, every grain of sand, as you know, the poet William Blake said, contains the entire universe in some semblance. People have used this to explain psychic phenomena or how we can seemingly access information from other people's minds, because if each of us contains in some sense the entire universe, if we can access where that information is, we can access things in other people's minds. You know, many, many parapsychologists have pointed out how interesting this is so. I'm sure a lot of you have probably heard of the remote viewing experiments at Stanford, where they would take people and they would have a person back at the lab just sitting there, and then they'd send out a person somewhere and they'd say, okay, a prescribed time, try to tell what that other person is looking at. And they would send that other person to a location chosen at random, and the other person would describe this amazing, the person sitting in the lab would describe with amazing accuracy what the other person was looking at. And it's interesting. These remote viewing experiments, have been about 50 different labs around the world that have done them. And another interesting thing that's just a sort of a footnote is that in about 30 of the labs that have done it, they've gotten really positive results. About 20 of the labs have gotten no results, which is another thing that comes in psychic phenomena. I think phenomena have to do with consciousness in general, and that is you can't quantify them with the same precision that you can quantify the way that billiard balls strike each other in a table, because consciousness is a more mercurial thing. And a lot of people say, well, if you can't duplicate it every time, it doesn't exist. But it's clear that when we're working in this realm, that's not necessarily true. And many of you probably heard of the great physician René Dubos, and he says sometimes the most measurable, if we only focus on the most measurable, we push out sometimes the most important. And I think that in this area that's true. So this is a very important application of the holographic idea, but it's not one that I'm going to talk about too much today, but I did want to just mention it. One that is much more appropriate to what I'm going to talk about today is that has to do with this idea that we do construct holograms in our head for what's out there. And I'm sure all of you have heard the conundrum, you know, at some point in your life you've thought, well, if when I look at green and you look at green, do we each see the same thing? I mean, we'd each describe it as green, but we don't really have any knowledge of whether we're each perceiving the same thing. It's difficult to know. And Pribram has really taken this to an extreme, because he says that really, since all of our reality is a mental construct in our head, we don't know that we're all that reality is out there. And he kind of, even though he fudges a little on this, because it is a very radical thing for an academic type person to be saying, but he if you back him into a corner, which I've done on occasion, he will say that he really doesn't believe that the color green is out there, or that a tree, what we see inside our heads as a tree, is out there. What's out there, he says, is kind of a notion of frequency that we interpret and convert into these images. And again, this is the same in this TV analogy, is if you think about it, these are my words, not Pribram's, but it's almost as if we're all conscious TV sets, that what we have inside our head is the same as the image on the TV. But just as Johnny Carson isn't in your living room when you're watching him on the TV, Pribram is saying that the color green and the table and everything that are out there aren't really out there when you're watching them. What's out there are these frequencies that your mind converts into a hologram to look at these things. Now, this idea that we don't respond to reality that we respond to our internal hologram or model of reality, has been used by a lot of people as an explanatory principle for some amazing things. And one is there have been lots of studies. I mean, there have been studies of basketball players, for example, where they'll take one group of basketball players and they'll have them just practice shooting baskets. Then they'll take one group and they'll have them practice shooting baskets in their mind and do that exclusively. And then they'll take a third group and have them practice shooting basketballs in their mind and practice in reality. And it turns out that the ones who only shoot basketballs in their mind are almost as adept at doing it after they practice this for a while as the ones who do it in reality, that their bodies respond to this model of reality in an extraordinary way. And an example that I've given in some of the other talks that I hope you'll forgive me if I repeat it, because I think it bears repeating, especially some of the stuff that we're going to get to in a minute, is an Israeli study where a fellow took a group of soldiers and he divided them up into three, and they were all marching 25 miles. But he didn't tell them, each of the groups, what they were marching. One group he told the truth. He said, you're marching 25 miles. One group he said, you're marching like 10 miles. Another group he said, you're like marching 35 miles. And when they got done, he performed all these physiological measurements, and he discovered that they didn't respond to the actual amount of miles that they had marched. They responded to their idea of what they thought they had marched. And I think, I mean, we're going to return to this idea of us responding to our idea of the world more than what's out there again and again throughout this talk. So it's really important to kind of keep it in mind. I've talked in some of the other talks, and I want to just repeat some of the information about this idea that we respond to our idea of the world. And in my lecture today, I talked a bit about stigmatists. Stigmatists are, you know, stigmata are these this phenomena where people, in their bodies, they reproduce the wounds of the crucifixion. And the interesting thing is that stigmatists, it's been shown that they each manifest the wounds in a different way, which would not be if they were manifesting the wounds of a historical Christ. If they were actually manifesting historical reality, they would all have identical wounds, but they don't. And in fact, people who have studied this have found that what they really manifest is the wounds as they appear in their favorite painting of the crucifixion. And so this may sound heretical, but it's there are even theologians who have pointed this out. One is a fellow named Herbert Thurston, which, if you ever want to read a book, it's kind of difficult to get a hold of, but it's called The Physical Phenomena of Mysticism by Herbert Thurston. And it will really sort of blow your mind when you read it, because it is absolutely filled with things that people, through the product of their faith, have been able to manifest. Just another example out of that, I forget the exact term for it. I think it's they call them rings of Christ or something. But there, you know, in the Catholic religion, there's the belief that if you become a nun, you're in essence married to Jesus. And it turns out that there have been people all throughout the ages that nuns who, after they feel that they're married to Jesus, their finger manifests an indentation as if they have a wedding ring on. And sometimes this is sometimes it's different colors appear in the skin and things like this. And Thurston talks about this in the book. But again, it's an example of how we can manifest our model of reality causes us to influence the way that our body manifests, I believe. One of the most striking examples of this is there are even stigmatists who manifest actual nails in their hand. Their flesh grows into nails, which is an extraordinary thing if you think about it, that by imagining an image or a hologram of their body in their mind, they can re-sculpt the body to form a nail. And in fact, these nails are so complete. St. Francis was the first saint, the first stigmatist to manifest these nail-like protuberances in the flesh. And witnesses reported that when you pressed on one end, the other end would go out a little, that you could actually wiggle it back and forth. So his body had actually grown out of his flesh, this synthetic nail. Now this is, you know, this is kind of even a kind of a creepy thing. But the bottom line is, I mean, I'm of course not telling you to all go out and grow nails out of your hands, but if they can, you know, if a person through the power of deep faith can manifest a nail, what could we do if we decided to sort of consciously focus that deep faith to re-sculpt our bodies and to manifest things? And that's the reason that I'm telling you these things. To give you another example of an amazing, some amazing things that stigmatists have manifested, there was an 18th century Italian stigmatist named Veronica Giuliana. And she had how Christ had allegedly a wound in his side. Well, she had a wound that would open and close on command. I don't know why, but that, I mean, to me, it's amazing that that physiologically, she somehow on some unconscious level, she was able to access the programming that would open and close this wound, so that, you know, if a priest would say, well, let's see the wound open, it would open up. Now, when you get cut, you don't think you have that control. And, of course, most of us can't consciously access that control. In fact, Veronica Giuliani was not consciously accessing it, I suspect. I think it was operating at a deeply unconscious level. But again, what if, you know, we wouldn't need stitches if we could all access this ability. And even more astonishing, one day after having a vision, Veronica Giuliani said, well, I think that the wounds are the symbols of the stigmata are now etched on my heart. And everyone said, what do you mean? She said, well, I think that I had this vision and I saw that Christ burned into my heart a crown of thorns, a cross, a sword, and three nails. And everyone was okay. And after she died, an autopsy was performed, and in scar tissue on her heart was a crown of thorns, a cross, a sword, and three nails. Now, this is pretty amazing if you think about it, that her mind was able, I mean, she wasn't even looking to see what she was doing inside her body, but somehow the you know, the exquisite genius of the unconscious was able to put those things there without having vision as we know it. Obviously, it has some kind of vision to do that. And again, as I say, my point is not just to stress the oddness of it, but to say, if they can do that, what could we do by really consciously manifesting this ability in a very, you know, a more positive way, a more directed way. One thing that I also want to mention that I mentioned in the talk, but that will come up a couple of times in this workshop, are people with multiple personality disorder. And this is really the most striking example of the connection between maybe our psyche and illness, because, you know, people, as I'm sure a lot of you know, people who have multiple personality disorder have almost invariably had some profound sexual and physical abuse as children, usually at a very early age. And it really seems to be a kind of survival strategy for the self, that because the self can't endure the pain that the individual is going through, the self divides. And again, here's, as I point out in the book, this is interestingly holographic, because it doesn't divide into fragments in the sense of being, you know, just an ego without a memory or whatever. It divides into smaller wholes, smaller complete personalities. But even more intriguingly, these smaller complete personalities, as each one sort of takes over the body, they will have different medical conditions. There's a case of one woman who had a non-malignant tumor with one personality, but when she shifted to another, the tumor would vanish. Now, this is pretty amazing, you know, that we have this physiological mechanism at some level, clearly, that we can do this. There are people with diabetes, there are people with allergies who can shift from one to the other. They can even shift eye color. I'm going to mention some other things they can do a little later in the talk. But this, you know, as I say, we're looking at all these things to sort of say, okay, if this is part of human potential, what does this mean? What is our potential? The third area of that the holographic idea has pretty astounding implications is all of these things that I've talked about really probably involve just undiscovered biological pathways. They don't necessarily involve anything paranormal. There's not necessarily anything paranormal in the fact that we can open and close a wound. It may just be that our bodies have that control. In fact, some of these things, for example, I talked about Veronica Giuliani able to manifest, you know, the emblems of the crucifixion on her heart. There are people who have been hypnotized, and they can have numbers and letters appear on their skin as red patches on their skin just through hypnotic suggestion. So this doesn't, as I say, this does not necessarily seem paranormal, but there are an area that I'm very interested in, because I've lived a life that's quite filled with paranormal phenomena, is that I think that the holographic idea does go into realms where maybe the laws of physics are challenged, or at least that there are laws that we haven't discovered yet. There are things going on that we haven't quite discovered and need to look at, not the least of which is this Bavarian stigmatist that I mentioned, Theresa Neumann. When she would go into a trance and the wounds of the crucifixion would appear on her, they would always place her in a bed. She'd be reclining, and the blood that would come out of the wound on her feet would not drip down, because she was, in her mind, she was mimicking the way Christ was on the cross. And of course, he was hanging on the cross this way, not lying in a bed. So the blood, after it left the wound, would go horizontally around her foot before it would drip down. Now, this to me suggests that this is something that isn't just an undiscovered biological pathway, because how can the mind control the way that the blood would flow? This is pretty trippy. And there are many areas where these kind of things occur. The most amazing one to me, even though it has been challenged as being kind of suspect because it happened quite a while ago, involves a thing called the Jansenist miracles, which occurred in the beginning of the 1700s in France. And the Jansenists were Catholics really masquerading as Protestants in 18th century France under Louis the 15th. And the church was not very charitable toward Protestants at that time. In fact, they were outlawed in France. And so the Jansenists called themselves Catholics, even though they held Protestant beliefs. And the church was really quite upset about this, and Louis was quite upset about this, Louis the 15th. And consequently, there was this tremendous prejudice against the Jansenists. The problem was there were lots of Jansenists, and they were very politically powerful and very wealthy. So Louis was afraid to really clamp down on them because of this, but the church was constantly pressuring him, saying, get rid of these people, you know, these are Protestants. And so it was a very tense situation. The reason I'm describing the situation is after when we start to look at some of the mechanisms behind the way that these miracles are manifested, it's kind of important to know that they come out in these specialized situations, not just normal frames or states of consciousness, but either deep religious faith or things like this. In this particular situation, I think the reason that these miracles were able to manifest was because of this potent sort of tension and belief that tension and emotional power that was attached to these events is what assisted these people in transcending the normal rules that govern reality. Now the Jansenists, what happened is there was a Jansenist leader who died, very influential leader, and the Jansenists, he was buried in a cemetery in Paris, and the Jansenists, his followers, started gathering around the tomb. And the first thing that happened is that people started, who were touching the tomb, started having miraculous healings. And so word spread that if you touched this guy's tomb, you could maybe get healed. So thousands of people showed up trying to get healed. And eventually, this is, you know how mobs are, that when you have a big mob of people, things get sort of broiling and get out of control. And people started going into sort of religious fervor and trances. And, of course, in their mind is this attitude that they're in this danger because the church could clamp down on them at any moment, especially since they're having this huge demonstration. You know, it was kind of the 17th or the 18th century French version of Tiananmen Square, in a sense. That, you know, they started thinking, well, they got quite belligerent and thought, well, we can't be hurt. Well, they won't be able to hurt us. And when they would go into this trance, something quite amazing happened. It became discovered that they literally couldn't be hurt. And so they started sort of exulting in this. They would have people try to stab them, people try to kill them with sledgehammers, people try to kill them with hatchets. They couldn't be wounded. Now this, you know, this stretches the imagination, and one can rightfully ask, well, did this really occur? Is this at all conceivable? Is something this extraordinary could occur? And I think that's a valid question, but there are compelling reasons to at least treat this, to not dismiss this out of hand. One is that this was no flash in the pan set of phenomena. It went on for over two decades and involved literally tens of thousands of people. In fact, the women who would go into these trances, because they were wearing dresses, sometimes they would flip over, and of course the sexual mores of the time, you didn't want to expose yourself. So the Jansenist powers that be hired people to watch and make sure that no one ever really, you know, that they would, when these women would be out of control and in these trances, they hired people to make sure their dresses were always down in this. And in the books that we find, although we don't have accurate assessments of how many people were involved in these religious demonstrations, that we do know that they hired 3,000 people just to make sure that everyone kept their dresses down. So this gives you some idea of what the numbers involved in this. And it's curious to me, not only that this was such a massive phenomenon, I mean, everyone in Europe was talking about this for two decades, and yet we don't even, you probably, most of you, have never heard of the Jansenist miracles. And it's because I think it's such an assault on our picture of reality that we have no choice, but history has kind of swept it under the rug. It's like, well, this can't be, let's not deal with this. But the Jansenists, they would, as I say, they would have people, you know, accounts of them being hurt, and of course, the Catholic Church went nuts over this because these were Protestants masquerading as Catholics, and they didn't want them performing miracles because that added legitimacy to their cause. So the Catholic Church sent all sorts of people to observe and to hopefully discredit and disprove these phenomena. And one by one, they all came back and said, it's absolutely real. These things are occurring. And in fact, there's a French representative of the church, a man named Montgeron, who wrote four very massive volumes on the things that he observed during these Jansenist miracles. Unfortunately, they're only written in French, and only portions of them have been translated, but the fragments that have been translated, and if you're lucky enough to read French, if you could read these things, it's quite amazing, the things that he reports. I mean, there's one woman an account where he gives where a woman had her she got up so that the base she was balanced on the tip of a spike embedded in the ground at the base of her spine, and she had like a 50-pound stone dropped from a height, you know, of like 20 feet onto her stomach repeatedly, and she was not punctured. You know, these things are really extraordinary challenges to our picture of reality. And as I say, I don't know that these things occurred. I wasn't there, but the fact that they occurred for so long with so many people involved, that even the skeptics who didn't want to legitimize them wrote back reports saying these things occurred, I think are compelling reasons for to at least not dismiss them out of hand. Now, so what does this mean? Is it possible that the sort of extreme version of the holographic idea is right, that reality does not exist in the sense that we think it is, that it's not really real, that what's out there is this ocean of frequency, and that we are these conscious television sets, you know. In fact, we're not even television sets, because that too is a hologram, to think of ourselves as something drifting through this, because we're part of the hologram too. We have, you know, we don't really have any location in this ocean of energy. The fact that we sort of dream ourselves or view ourselves as having bodies is again a hologram. There's a psychologist named Keith Floyd, because Pribram started by saying, well, maybe the brain creates holograms, and Keith Floyd said, well, you know, the more you think about it, the more it looks like maybe the hologram creates the brain, that there's the other way around, that the brain too is as illusory as the, you know, some of these things that we consider illusory perceptions. So the first thing that I'd like to do is give you a couple of examples that can kind of, because these things are, we've been so indoctrinated to believe that reality is real, that even if you kind of intellectually accept miracles, there's still all this programming that makes you go, well, this can't be, you know, I can't quite buy this. And so there are just a couple of exercises, one of which involves this sheet of paper that I've handed out. Is there anyone who doesn't have one of these? Okay, if you don't have one, there's a stack of them up here. Yeah, the church did crack down on them.
Okay.
But it's interesting, because in that same time period there were other religious movements that the church was either in the process of cracking down on or deciding to crack down on were similar. There were similar outbreaks of miracles. There was a group called the Commissards, and the Commissard leader, when they were about to be attacked and basically massacred, stood upon a pyre of wood and had it set on fire, and he delivered a speech as the fire burned around him. And the fire completely burned itself out. The flames wrapped around him all the while he spoke, and then he came out unharmed. And one of the Catholic investigators in that one wrote back that even when they wrapped cloth around some of these individuals and doused it with oil and set it on fire, that the cloth would burn off and they would be unharmed afterwards. And again, you know, because these are so far in the past, they can rightfully be held suspect. But we do have sort of current day incidents of all these things. There's a Jansenist too I talk about in the book. There were a couple of Jansenists that were known as human salamanders, and the reason they were known as human salamanders is there's a medieval belief that we know about the belief that there are only four elements in the earth, air, fire, and water. And it was a sort of a medieval belief that every element had a spirit associated with it. The earth had gnomes, the air had fire had a spirit called salamanders. And these weren't the amphibians that we know the word salamander. To the medieval mind, a salamander was the spirit of the fire. And these human salamanders, there was one woman who would have a fire built, and she would stick her head in the fire. And her hair would be so hot afterwards that people couldn't touch it. She would hold her head in the fire for minutes on end, and it wouldn't. But nothing would be scorched or burned. Everything should be completely intact, but people couldn't touch her. She was so hot afterwards. Which again, you know, if the world is as real and as solid as we think it is, how does this occur? If this occurred, a more modern example that I've mentioned in one of my earlier talks, Bernadette Subaru, and I think this is probably quite credible. Bernadette Subaru, the little girl who saw the vision of the Virgin at Lourdes when she was in trance once, she went into this sort of prayer-like trance and drooped her hand into a candle flame, and her physician, family physician, who was very skeptical, that everyone in the community was very skeptical that these miracles were occurring, that she was actually seeing the Virgin, watched, along with several other people, as she just held her hand in the candle flame, and the flame wrapped around her finger for a full 10 minutes. And I'm sure all of you have heard of, you know, fire walking. People explain, say, well, their feet are sweaty and they walk quickly and all this. Well, sweaty fingers don't preserve your hand, you know, for 10 minutes with a candle flame wrapped around. We don't know, but if you look at all these things sort of combined together, all of these pieces of evidence, there's you know, an enormous sort of picture of these things happening. I mean, you go back to the tales of who were the Meshach, Shadrach, and Abednego in Nebuchadnezzar's furnace. You know, that there are all kinds of stories throughout history of people being, you know, not being burned by fire. And can it possibly be that we've all sort of hypnotized ourselves into believing that fire burns, and that's, you know, at some level that, you know, if we shift our awareness or our attitude, we can be protected. I think it is possible. A lot of people challenge that, and I could be wrong, but that's, you know, that's my prejudice. These, getting back to these exercises, this first one is a simple way of showing, because when we look out there, everything seems so real that it's hard to imagine that it's really not there. You go, well, I can see the, you know, the pink of that paper, or, you know, the blue of the wall or whatever. And yet there's a very simple demonstration that shows how adept your brain is at constructing reality. And it has to do with the fact that we all have a blind spot at the back of our eye where the optic nerve connects to the retina. We have no visual receptors. And yet your brain, so when you look out there, you've got two holes in your reality. But your brain does, like nature abhors a vacuum, well, your brain does also. It doesn't want you to see two gaping holes in your reality. So it knits in what it thinks is real. And this is an exercise to quickly demonstrate that you're doing this. Now, to do this, first close your left eye and stare at the circle in the middle of the grid with your right eye. And then move the paper around till the star vanishes. Okay, this is where I have to hold it for it to vanish for me. So if you're having trouble, try holding it about here. I'm closing my left eye, looking at the circle in the middle of the grid with my right eye, and right now I can't see the star.
When you say the blind spot, is that the blind spot?
Yes, at the back of your retina, you have an area where you have no visual receptors. Now, your brain, as I said, doesn't want you to see this. So if you do this, you can move this. If you do it properly, you can move it into a place where the star absolutely vanishes and you can't see it. That's because it's in the blind spot of your eye. Now, if you're having trouble, if the person next to you is able to do it, maybe they can assist you, because some people start to have problems. And if you're having problems, the thing is, because you just keep moving the paper around in different places, because it may be over here, it may be over here. So don't be too rigid in the way that you hold the paper, where you're holding the paper.
It disappears totally. Yeah, it disappears.
It disappears totally.
It disappears totally. There's only one point.
Well, if it's...
It's closer. Bring it closer to you.
Oh! I just brought it closer.
How far are
we? Well, it gets a little further out. After you've done that, now we're going to do something different. Close your right eye this time and stare at the star and move it around till the circle in the middle of the grid disappears. Now, when that happens, I want you to notice something. You can no longer see that dot in the middle of the grid, but what happens is you don't see a hole in the grid. The grid still looks intact. Mm-hmm. And that's because your brain is assessing what should be there from what's around. And it doesn't want you to see a hole there, so it fills in the grid. And so that's a very quick demonstration that your brain is creating reality. Now, you didn't know you had that ability, probably, but your brain can create this reality so artfully. You can look at a Van Gogh painting or a Persian carpet, and your brain can fill in the gap, and you've never even realized it, that your brain is constructing that bit. So this is a kind of demonstration for you can, you know, if you're saying, well, how could it be that something doesn't exist and yet our brains are sort of giving us a hologram, making us see it? If you do this, this at least shows you that it opens the door on the possibility of it. There's if you're having problems with it, just take this and, you know, work with it, because eventually you'll get it. And the basic thing, key to doing it, is finding the right spot. Now, a second exercise I want to show you, because it's, you can go, okay, well, I can buy that maybe I don't see what's out there, but it's still out there. Like, maybe when I look at this podium and you look at this podium, internally we're seeing different colors. We may agree at call it the same thing, but we may be having the internal experiences different. But we all know how solid this is. You can't deny that. You bump in against it and you can't move your hand through it. So there's a Tai Chi exercise that you can use to show that your brain can also construct the illusion of solidity, and that's what we're going to do next. And to do that, you take your left hand and you clamp it on your right wrist like this. Now what you do is you push up very hard with your right hand, but with an equal and opposing force press down with your left hand. So you've got all this, with all your strength in both, so that you've got all this tension going on. Now don't release any of that tension. All the while I'm talking, I want you to continue to do that. Now, first just focus on the intersection between the two arms and feel all that tension of all your strength, you know, pressing. Now what I want you to do is shift the focus of your attention without releasing any of this tension. Shift the focus of your attention to just your right arm and feel the tightness in your muscle all through your arm and up into your shoulder of what you're doing. Hold your focus of your attention on that what's going on in your arm. Don't release any of the tension in your right arm. Hold it there, but lift your left arm away. Now you notice when you lifted your keep holding that tension. Now you thought you were pushing up with your right hand, but when you moved your left arm away, your arm didn't go up. So the fact that... Well, if it did...
We're weird.
No, if it did, it meant that you shifted. I mean, you notice most of the people's didn't. So what that means is that you shifted in a different way. You didn't hold the tension in your arm. You started to change it. So try it again.
What's supposed to happen? Just stay the same.
It stays the same.
Oh, okay, it stayed the same first, but then it popped. Does that make sense?
Well, if it starts to go up, it's because you change your mental construct of what's going on, because you think, oh, it has to go up. Because as you notice, most of people's arms stayed in exactly the same spot, but they thought they were pressing up.
You might say that they were
now press down.
And then it went.
Yeah, well, that's you shifted. And there's the reason that Tai Chi masters teach this is to show you that all obstacles, although you think they exist out there, they exist in the head. So, of course, it sort of adds new relevance. You know, everyone says, well, all obstacles that you perceive in life are created by yourself. They're an illusion. And it sounds all well and good, but then when you do this, it's like, wait a second, here's an obstacle where you thought you were pressing up, and yet it existed only in your head. Now, what's even more interesting about this is that as long as that obstacle is there, you can't move your arm till you release pressing against what you think is an obstacle. That not only are you pressing against an obstacle that's illusory, but it's freezing up your system so that while you're exerting all this energy pressing against something that really doesn't exist, you can't do something else. You can't be free to use your arm. And this is why it's said that Tai Chi masters, because one of the things about Tai Chi is to learn to drop all your belief that obstacles exist out there, and that, you know, to overcome that. And that's why it said that a talented Tai Chi master can knock a person across the room with a flick of their finger. You know, they no longer believe that reality works only that way. They believe that reality works in a different way. Now, these things, you know, when we're talking about these things, I've talked about sort of two categories of things. One, as I say, involve kind of just things that we can accept don't violate the laws of physics. They may be undiscovered biological pathways. One, we talk about, you know, where something trippy does seem to be going on. You can stick your hand in candle flames and stuff like that. The reason I'm talking about this, I'm not here to teach you how to stick your hand in a candle flame, but I think the same techniques that you would use for all of these can also be applied in a very practical way in your life. And in fact, I'm very convinced, you know, that I'll tell you a little story. When I was on touring for this book, I did a radio interview in San Francisco, and the fellow that was a guest host, he was not the regular host, and as a consequence, he had not gotten the message that the publishing company had confirmed the fact that I was going to be there. He was sweating it out, thinking he might have dead airspace, that I wasn't going to be on the radio, and I arrived there about 5 minutes before the radio show. And he'd been so nervous thinking that he wasn't going to have a show that he screamed his head off at me, why didn't you call and confirm? Not realizing that we had called and confirmed, was absolutely livid and rushed me into the studio, put on his headsets, immediately went on the air, and as soon as he went on the air, you know, he had this new age show, he went, hello, and immediately shifted into this thing. And I thought, well, this is just not right, you know. This is all a put on, this sort of peace, love, and light business. And I'm not saying this, I mean, just to be glib, because I really think, you know, there are people A lot of times when you sort of work in this area, you know, New Age type things, like I'm sure you've met people who have their crystals and say their mantras and do their meditation, yet what they really should be doing is going to a therapist, you know. I'm not being glib about this, because I really do think, one thing that we do in our lives is that we tend to divide our everyday life from the spiritual. And I think that's totally wrong, because I think the two are interconnected, and that probably for a lot of people it's far more spiritual to be going to a therapist than to be saying their mantra. That's the best thing, the most spiritual thing they can be doing. And so when I talk about these things, you know, even though I don't make that distinction, because I think that, you know, first of all, I don't believe that any of us should be aiming toward acquiring the ability to stick our hand in a candle flame just for the sake of doing that. But the reason that I talk about it and the reason that I focus on some of these things is, as I say, because developing those skills of being able to do that are going to help you wherever you're at. It's not that the goal is to stick your hand in a candle flame. The goal is to just, you know, be alive, healthy, and happy. And I don't divide the biological and everyday world from the spiritual world, because I've long believed that the body is really just the most solid portion of the soul, that there isn't this division that a lot of religions teach. Before I move on, I just want to mention one other thing about in this area of healing. Like, we looked at several different categories of healing, or let's say body manipulation. One involved people who were able to access some extraordinary level of reality through religious faith. Let me tell you a couple of quick stories about some healings for the purpose of looking at the mechanisms behind them. There's a story in the book that I talk about where a fellow had lymphatic cancer, had tumors the size of oranges all throughout his body. His doctor felt he had only several days left to live, and he heard about a new chemotherapy, and he said, "Doctor, you got to put me on this chemotherapy." And the doctor said, "Well, it takes weeks to take effect. It's not going to help you." And he said, "Please, please, just put me on it." So the doctor put him on it. And 3 days later, the man's tumors had melted, as the doctor put it, like snowballs in a hot stove. The guy's up. He resumes his life. He's fine. A couple of months later, reports on this drug come in saying it's not as effective as everyone thought. Bam, 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 the guy's tumors come back. He's back in the hospital. And the doctor starts to realize it wasn't this drug that did this. And so he says to the guy, he lies to the guy. He says, "Well, listen, those reports are wrong. And not only are they wrong, but I have an even more potent version of this new drug. I'm going to give you this more potent version." And he injects the guy with just salt water. Well, the guy, because he believes in it, his tumors melt away again, like snowballs in a hot stove. Faster, as the doctor put it, than even the strongest radiation treatment could have melted them away. A couple of months later, the guy reads final reports on the drug, says it's absolutely ineffective. His tumors come back and he dies. But the bottom line is that, you know, he had this latent ability to heal himself. But he's been taught from day one that he can't do that, you know. He can't heal himself. So he, to access that belief system in him, and I call it the infinite self, because I say, you know, the only self in us that has limits is the conscious self. Beneath the conscious self, there's an infinite self that has no limits, that can do anything. But because we're so indoctrinated to believe that we have limits, most of the ways that these extraordinary events are accessed are through sort of accidents in general. I mean, or through sort of serendipity, like, as I say, religious faith. In this particular instance, this was not religious faith. It was faith in technology or science, faith that this drug would heal him, but not faith that he had the healing capacity himself. Another thing that often accesses these sorts of things are cases, of course. One case I talk about in the book where this young boy has... I forget the technical name for the disease, but colloquially it's referred to as alligator skin. It's a genetic condition where your skin gets very hard and rough and scaly. People in freak shows were labeled as, you know, the alligator boy, the alligator woman, whatever, who had this condition. As they say, it's a genetic condition. Well, this guy, a doctor who did hypnosis, a therapist, decided to try an experiment. And he hypnotized the kid and he said his skin was returning to normal. He did this over a period of sessions. And lo and behold, the kid's skin returned to normal. Now, they discovered that he had to have follow-up sessions for the rest of his life, telling his unconscious mind, or as I would put it, the infinite self, that his skin was normal. But here's another instance where, you know, we're taught, we have this very pervasive belief system that if you're genetically predisposed to something, if it's a genetic condition, that's it. It's absolute. You don't overcome it. It's your destiny. It's your blueprint. Live with it. This kid, you know, he believed it consciously, so he couldn't access it, but this doctor, by using hypnosis, was able to access this deeper level of functioning where he was able to just switch it and override his own genetic programming. So I bring this up because I want to give you a variety of examples of how, you know, if you examine the literature, how people have accessed this. Now, so that, what is the link with all these things? And the link is, you know, that to access these extraordinary abilities, we have to bypass the limitations of our belief systems and to get into these things. Now, part of the problem and is that we all have been taught to believe that here we are extraordinary, we're, human beings are extraordinary because we have conscious minds. And I don't really mean to poo-poo the idea that the consciousness is extraordinary, but it doesn't take into account a whole lot of other things in us that are equally extraordinary that we tend to dismiss. Basically, I think the consciousness or self-aware part of us is really vastly overrated, because when you start to really examine these phenomena and other phenomena having to do with the human psyche, you discover that we're really iceberg beings. Most of us is beneath the surface, just a little bit of us. I call it the oil slick on the surface of the psyche, is the self-aware part. And most of us is beneath the surface, but we tend to think that most of us is conscious and there's just a little bit beneath the surface. And really just the opposite is true. So in doing this, you've got to kind of, you know, always keep this in mind. Don't think, well, I can't do that, because you've got this, most of you can do it. Just a little part of you can't do it. Let me give you an example of just some, you know, as I say, I believe that this unconscious part is the infinite self. It can do anything. But how is it that we seal ourselves off from this infinite potential? You know, what processes go on that close these doors to us? I have an example. When I was a child, I grew up, as I mentioned, had a lot of paranormal phenomena happen, One thing that I could do is I could sort of perform a shift inside my head that would enable me to see other realities. When I would look at the sky, I could shift and I could see these other beautiful landscapes that and as a child, of course, you don't have the intellectual savvy you do as an adult, so I didn't know that it was abnormal what I was doing, and I didn't know what it was. And one day I said to my mother, "Is that heaven? When I do that, am I looking at heaven?" She said, "Yeah, you're looking at, that's heaven." She thought I was being poetic. So I thought, okay, great, that's heaven, I get it. This makes sense to me now. And one day when I was five, I was staring at the sky, and I'd done this shift, and I was looking at this beautiful landscape of these mountains, and the technicolor, just beautiful colors, this land, this celestial vista that I was staring at, and it had two moons, and just, always, as I say, just extraordinary beauty. And I obviously had such a rapt expression on my face that it sort of my mother and my grandmother came up to me, and they said, "What on earth are you looking at?" And I said, "Well, I'm looking at heaven." And I said, "You mean you're looking at the heavens?" And I said, "No, I'm looking at heaven, you know, the two moons, the mountains, da-da-da-da." And I said, "There's nothing like that there. That's just sky." And I thought, well, that's awfully puzzling that they don't see that. But what I didn't realize and what happened is that was the last time I saw heaven. So clearly, I mean, we have this tremendous drive to lock into the consensus. And that's one thing that shuts us off from the infinite self. I mean, there have been, you know, experiments. There was an experiment performed by a psychologist named Solomon Ox. Where he would take a room full of people, and he would draw a line on the blackboard 5 inches long and a line, say, 10 inches long. And he'd have send one person out on some sort of spurious errand, like, you know, go get something. And he'd tell everyone in the room, he'd say, "When they come back, I'm going to ask you if these lines are different in length or the same in length. And then, but I want you all to say they're the same, even though they're drastically different." So poor person that's the dupe in the experiment would come back and he'd go, "Okay, I've drawn two lines on the board. Are they the same or are they different?" And everyone who thinks they're the same length, raise your hand. Everyone would raise their hand. And of course, the hand would shoot up at the person that was out of the room, because they didn't want to be the only person who saw a different reality from everyone else. And I think we even do this at a deeply unconscious level, because we're so programmed to think, you know, that there's a strategy and consensus, that we have to agree with the consensus. And I'm sure it had survival value when we were hunter-gatherers, but it doesn't have survival value when you're in the hospital with cancer, you know, and everyone's telling you you're going to die. Then you can't buy into the consensus, because then you're closing yourself off to as I say, the infinite self. And there are all kinds of examples of people doing this, you know, that we still have these abilities within us, but we've closed ourselves off to it. There's an interesting story in I don't know if any of you have read a book called The Inner Game of Tennis by a guy named Tim Galway. And what he does is he would teach people to improve their tennis stroke. And he would take them and he'd say, well, you know, they'd say, "Well, I'd really like to improve my game." And he has this trick. He'd say, "Well, show me how you'd like to hit the ball." And they'd go, "Well, I'd really like to be able to hit it like this." And they'd hit it like that. And they'd go, "Show me that again." And they'd go, "Well, I'd really like to be able to hit it like this." He'd have them do it 3 or 4 times. And then he would say, "Well, it's too bad you can't hit it like that." And then it would hit them that they were able to hit it the way they'd always wanted to, but they'd always felt they couldn't until he sort of tricked them into doing it. And so sometimes we have to sort of trick ourselves into it, and sometimes people, just by dint of ignorance, are lucky enough to not buy into this consensus. And there's so many stories, especially in the medical literature, of this happening. One incident that I talk about in the book involves a woman who came in. She had a huge brain tumor, and the doctor said, well, she's going to die. And so all they could do was debulk it. They took some of it out, and they sent her home to die. And they, one thing they did do is they decided to have her set up an appointment with a biofeedback therapist to deal with the excruciating agony they were sure she was going to be in. And she went home, and she started seeing this biofeedback therapist, and the biofeedback therapist was the only one who saw her because the doctors had written her off. And as the months went by, she got better, and finally she came back to the biofeedback therapist, said, because the woman had been paralyzed on one side of her body from this brain tumor also, and she started walking better and looking more hale and hearty. The biofeedback therapist said, I think you should go see your doctors. I think you're really improving. She went, and her tumor was completely gone, and her doctor said, well, my gosh, this is absolutely amazing. You know, no one recovers from this kind of cancer. And she said, oh, really? Now, what's cancer again? She didn't know what cancer was. And fortunately for her, she had escaped that belief and that limitation. And this, there's so many stories. Bernie Siegel, in his book, Love, Medicine, Miracles, if you've read that book, he talks about a woman, or a man, he's like an elderly guy. He comes in, he has lymphatic cancer all throughout his body. He's so elderly, they decide not to put him on chemotherapy or treat him. And they basically, the family is told, but the fellow who has the cancer is not told. And they send him home thinking, well, instead of having him live in terror and, you know, for the last days of his life, we will just keep this terrible information from him. Well, the guy's son contacted Siegel 15 years later and said, well, Dad's still alive. He didn't know he was supposed to die, so fortunately he didn't. Now, unfortunately, this doesn't happen with everyone, and I think that, you know, it's more complex issue than just not being told something. But these are examples. I'll give you just another quick example. There's also an account of a woman who had a brain tumor, again sent home to die, and she decided that she would go on Laetril, and she went down to Mexico and she got Laetril, and the doctors felt she had only a few days left to live, or weeks, and she went on this Laetril and really just got her health back, resumed her life, and was running around, and like a year later, she ran into one of the doctors who had told her, you know, who had sent her home. And when he met her, he said, my God, you're still alive. She went, yeah, so? And he said, well, you're supposed to die. And she said, I was. And he said, well, what did you do? And she said, well, I went on Laetril. And he said, Laetril is worthless. Well, she went home and died that day, you know. And that, you know, we do want those lines to be the same. And what I'm saying is that, you know, sometimes we have to disagree with a consensus to make, you know, because sometimes the lines aren't the same even though everyone else thinks they are. Now, you know, there are all kinds of examples of reaccessing the infinite self. You've all heard stories of, you know, there was a 12-year-old, a story in San Diego about a 12-year-old, his father's working on a truck falls on him, and he lifts the truck off. Of course, he can't lift the truck off in his normal state of mind, but for those few brief seconds of panic, he put aside the belief that he was, you know, had this limitation, and was able to lift this truck off. Another story, which could be just a fluke, but I think that we can maybe read something more into it. This was in San Francisco a few years back. A fellow was very high on drugs, and he strolled out his window of his 24th floor, or 24th apartment, fell 20 stories to the street below and broke his ankle and walked away. And afterwards recovered and discovered what he'd done and said, my God, I should have been killed. But he didn't realize that while he'd fallen, so he didn't, you know. Now, again, because you go, well, this is solid, this has to be here, and if someone says, hey, do you realize you could fall 20 stories and not die? You go, well, that's not possible, because the conscious mind, the oil slick on the surface of the infinite self, says, no, you're going to die. And there are systems, you know, that take advantage of this. You know, the Japanese Aikido always teach people to learn by not trying to do, but by just letting happen, which is kind of another way of accessing that deeper level. Because if you learn by trying to do, you know, if you think, well, I've got to do this, I've got to do it in this step, this. And it's the same, you know, if any of you have read that very famous book, Zen and the Art of Archery, you know, you don't do by thinking, how do I do it? You just do it by knowing you can do it and not thinking about it. And that's one trick. I mean, you can find it in all sorts of sources. This is what, you know, the Tai Chi masters do, same thing. And even Carlos Castaneda, in his journey to Ixalan, he talks about Don Juan has this thing called the Sorcerer's Gate, where he's able to walk at this amazing speed in the pitch black of night without tripping over any boulders. And he tells Carlos, you know, that the way that he does it is he just does it. He doesn't think about it. He just does it. And, you know, what on earth could we do if we didn't believe that we had these limitations. And it's not only in the realm of health. Another thing that I'm very big on, because part and parcel of my making my living is that I have to have a very good memory because I process a lot of information. People are always going, well, you're lucky, you have a great memory, I have a lousy memory. And I go, well, you've just told yourself you have a lousy memory. And, you know, there are all kinds of studies. Again, there's a biologist named Lyle Watson. They did, he's written a number of best-selling books, one of which was Supernature. And he was involved in some memory studies at a certain point where what they did is they filled a room just absolutely full of all kinds of clutter. And then they just had a window, sort of a peephole on the room. And they would open it up for like, you know, 5 seconds or whatever and have people look in. And then they close it and they go, okay, now try to tell everything that you remember seeing in the room. Well, this one, you know, they would tell people could remember maybe 10, 15 things that they'd seen in the room. And there are hundreds of things in the room. Then they would hypnotize them and say, how many things can you remember in the room? Well, people could remember an enormous number of things that were in the room once they hypnotized them because, you know, in my terminology, they're accessing the, you know, the part of us that believes in limitations. Not only that, they had one fellow who said, well, there's a newspaper lying on the opposite end of the room and it has articles on it. He named what the articles were about. And this struck Watson and his colleagues as very curious because they could see the newspaper, but they certainly couldn't read the titles of the articles. And they said, you can read the titles of the articles? This is under hypnosis. And he said, yeah. And they said, well, what else could you read? And he said, well, and not only in this brief look had he read the titles, he had read and memorized all the articles. But he couldn't do this consciously. He could do this unconsciously. You know, the infinite self could do this, like take in all that all at once. But consciously, you tell this guy that he has twice as good eyesight as he thinks. In fact, he has extraordinary eyesight. Can, you know, all these feet away can read and memorize these articles. No, he doesn't believe he can do it. So, of course, in his waking state, he can't do it. So one thing I'm always telling people, and you can use this in all sorts of, you know, things that you do, is don't, for, you know, for God's sakes, don't ever tell yourself what you can't do. You know, don't tell yourself what you can't remember, that you got a lousy memory. Even if your current reality is supporting the fact that maybe you're always forgetting stuff, but don't go, well, I'm sorry, I always forget stuff. And that's because the unconscious mind, at least a good portion of it, is like the genie in the story, the three wishes, you know, where you have to be very precise in what you tell it, what you say to it, because it buys everything automatically, says, okay, this has to be true. Now, anyone who's seen a stage show of hypnosis knows this. You know, you can hypnotize a person, give them a potato and say, this is an apple, and they'll eat it and with gusto think it's the most delicious apple they've ever eaten. The unconscious mind just accepts what you tell it. So it's always there. It's always in us all the time. And it accepts. You tell yourself you've got a bad memory. You tell yourself this. Whatever you tell yourself, it goes, oh, okay. Because it has an exquisite sensitivity. And that exquisite sensitivity just absorbs and takes in whatever you tell it. So part of accessing the unlimited self or the infinite self is really being incredibly vigilant and watching. It's a lot of work because you have to watch all the time. What are you telling yourself? What are you believing in that saying you can't do? You know, are you telling yourself I can't see that far? My eyesight's bad. This, you know, this is going, that is going. And, you know, just so, but there's so much evidence that we see, hear, know so many things. You know, there's evidence coming in that patients can hear what's being said to them under anesthesia. Well, everyone thought, well, that's not, no, we can't do that. But of course we can. In fact, you know, there are studies now, all kinds of studies. One study was done, a doctor told his patients while they were having surgery under anesthesia that when he came and talked to them after they were recovering, that they would tug on their ear. And every one of them tugged on their ear afterwards. You know, and doctors, you know, because when they were not cognizant of this fact, they would tell, you know, they would say all kinds of ghastly things about their patients. Well, this one's a goner. Well, that one's, you know, that, and they still do. And it's, you know, that, you know, heaven only knows how many people have died because what they were told while they were under anesthesia. And now there are some doctors who have become more enlightened who know about this. One doctor who frequently performs hip surgery, and of course, you know, you've got one part of the problem in surgery is bleeding, so all he does is he tells a person, oh, by the way, would you please shift all the blood away from your hip while I operate you? Well, they always do. The blood just goes to another part of their body, and he operates as, you know, a tenth of the bleeding most of the other doctors have. Similar studies, you know, there are instances where it used to be when every time you'd have lower back surgery, it would result in tremendous urinary problems. You'd have to have catheters and all this, and now the sort of movement in the medical literature to tell people when they're under anesthesia having lower back surgery, hey, you're going to be fine. You're not going to need a catheter. Well, now people don't, you know. And we do this, too, all the time. I mean, I'm sure you can think of instances where you tap into what I call this exquisite sensitivity. Like, I do it once. I mean, when I was a child, I hated, I'm sure a lot of you hated needles, you know, going, hated getting shots, hated it. I really hated it. I would scream like mad. And it got, even when I was an adult, the doctor came at me with a needle, they'd go, well, you've got great veins. And as soon as they'd go to stick a needle in, my veins would collapse. And they go, well, God, you look like you had great veins. I can't find the blood. And they'd be gouging me with a needle, you know, and I'd be sitting there in pain. And finally one day it hit me that I had great veins until they pointed out, and I went, oh, my God, this is going to hurt. And then immediately my body went, okay, it's going to hurt. Here you go. And do this. Now, another instance that I'm sure some of you have gone through is the same thing with, you know, people have problems swallowing pills. Now, I used to have a problem swallowing pills till one day I was gulping down a sandwich. I thought, I'm swallowing pieces of food that are much larger than any pill I've ever taken. And I'm not choking on this sandwich. Because while I was swallowing that pill, I was going, I'm going to choke. I'm going to choke. This is going to choke me. And I'd take the pill and it would stick right there in the throat. So now I just put myself in this, you know, this mindset of that what I'm doing is I'm swallowing food. I can swallow an enormous handful of pills now without choking. And this is apparent all throughout the animal kingdom, too, that we do this just naturally. Studies on dolphins show you try to take blood out of them, their veins immediately collapse. Now, they don't even know what you're doing, you know. I mean, as soon as they've been poked once or twice, you're not getting blood out of them. But what, you know, what can we, what does this tell us? What is the lesson inherent in this? And it's a very interesting lesson. It's probably one of the most important lessons that any of us have to learn in life. And that is that this unconscious mind, this infinite self with all of its exquisite sensitivity, interprets fear as a direction. And I really want you to think about this, because what are you doing when you fear something? All you're doing is running a model through your mind of this terrible scenario that's going to happen. Well, the unconscious mind, because it's like this genie, as I say in the story, that interprets everything literally, when you run the fearful scenario through your mind, your unconscious mind, which you can easily trick into thinking a potato is an apple, goes, oh, I'm supposed to do this. And it gives you exactly what you want, which is what it thinks you want. Really, you don't want it, but it doesn't know, because it speaks in the language of symbols. And, you know, all this talk about visualization and healing, well, what you're doing is a negative visualization on yourself when you do this, when you fear. Well, what I was doing when I thought, oh, my God, this is going to be hard. You're not going to get blood out of my vein. My body would immediately respond, go, oh, this is what he wants. The vein would collapse, or I can't swallow this pill. You know, my throat would instantly constrict. So, you always got to, again, be very careful. What is it that you're visualizing that you're inadvertently directing your infinite self, your unconscious self, to be doing for yourself? And the evidence, you know, in medical literature, because clearly, poor souls that we are as the human race, we're doing ourselves in. You know, there's an enormous amount of evidence now about the emotional contributions to disease. You know, studies of people with cancer that show that, you know, an amazing percentage of them, you know, within 2 years of the onset of the cancer had, you know, one of three things. They lost their means of livelihood, their home, or a significant relationship. So what are they doing? What they don't realize they're doing is they go into this depression, but what they're doing to the unconscious self that accepts everything because it's exquisitely sensitive, they're saying, I'm unhappy, life's not worth living. And the body responds. And there's, as I say, there's an enormous amount of evidence that's coming through. There's a woman named Jean Achterberg, some of you may be familiar with the work, and she's not the only person. A lot of people are doing this where they have people draw. But she did a series of studies where she had people draw pictures of their body over a period of time. These are just normal people. And then 5 years down the line, she kept medical follow-up records of these people. And she found that she, after examining and studying these drawings, that she could tell who was going to get cancer and what part of their body they were going to get cancer by how they had drawn their body 5 years before they got the cancer. So 5 years before they got the cancer, they're already telling this exquisitely sensitive self, this genie that accepts without questioning, what was wrong with their body. And I mean, you can think of this in a thousand different areas. You know, Louise Hay, who does a lot of work with AIDS patients, one of the things that she does, and I think it's crucially important, because she has this mirror exercise where you have to sit in front of a mirror and tell yourself that you love yourself. And when I first heard it, I thought, well, that's easy. I can do that. And I tried it, and it was, like, incredibly hard, you know, first time. And I started thinking about that and thinking in terms of how exquisitely sensitive our unconscious self is. And it occurred to me that unfortunately, most of us are brought up to have such terrible self-esteem. I mean, what do you do when you look in the mirror? Do you go, God, how healthy and wonderful and happy and successful I am, or do you go, God, does my hair look bad today? Or, no, geez, I wish I didn't have this. And here's this, as I say, this exquisitely sensitive, you know, infinite self that goes, oh, we're awful, we're bad, we're this, we're that. And I want to tell a story that actually I hope I don't embarrass you, Carol, because I'm going to identify you in this story. I have a friend here, Carol Dreyer, who had a part. Carol is a very talented clairvoyant, and she is the clairvoyant that's involved in this story. I was I had a health problem with my spleen, and so I thought, well, I'm going to do this visualization where I'm going to get my spleen better. Because the doctor was saying, well, we're going to have to do this hideous thing or that ghastly thing. And I was going, no, I could get rid of this with visualization. And I did it for a couple of months, and it just wasn't working. And finally, one day in the privacy of my apartment, I started to curse out my spleen. I said, damn it, why are you doing this to me? Why are you da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da? Why, you know, get your act in gear. And Carol came to visit. Carol lives in the Los Angeles area, but she came to visit me, and she started giving me a reading. And one of the first things she said, and I'd forgotten this incident. I hadn't said a thing. And she's a couple of seconds into the reading, she said, have you been yelling at your spleen? And I said, well, yeah, I have. I have been yelling at my spleen. She said, oh, well, it's very confused. She said, it's ill because it thinks it did what you want it to do. And now it's really upset because you're giving it a different direction. You're yelling at it saying, you know, you didn't do right. You know, I was putting in a double bind situation because the exquisitely sensitive self somehow, and I had to sort of find, you know, the psychological, emotional reasons that I had filtered this down into, you know, how my spleen had gotten ill, that I was telling it to get ill, but I didn't realize it because I was unconscious of the fact. And then here I was really doing it in by then yelling at it for this fact. And, you know, what I'm here to tell you is, you know, when you look in the mirror, and you find yourself looking at your deficits, not your pluses, you know, stop doing that. In fact, I mean, I think it's crucially important. You know, we are programmed. If you look, just take 5 minutes, even just 5 minutes of your life, and examine what you say about yourself. Are you critical of yourself? Do you count your deficits more than your attributes? And if so, knowing what, you know, some of these pieces of information about how extraordinarily sensitive this infinite self is, what are you doing to yourself when you do that? You know, what are you doing to yourself when you give it all these sort of belief system, toxic belief systems to do this? And, you know, one can go on and on in the medical literature, like another aspect of this, you know, telling the sensitive self these things that I think is very interesting that Bernie Siegel talks about in his books, other people talk about, is that he's constantly amazed at how people sum up through just their language what's happening to them. One fellow he was wheeling into surgery who had to have several inches of his intestine removed, and the guy said, you know, I'm really sort of upset that I have to have this surgery, but at least it gives me a chance to have a vacation because I'm going through this teaching training right now and I just can't handle all the shit that's in my life. I just can't handle the shit. And here he is. His body's gone, because, you know, as I said, your body's like the genie in the story of the three wishes. You think, I can't handle the shit. It goes, oh, it wants you to not be, you know, us to not be able to handle the shit. And you can read Siegel's books, and he's got instance after instance after instance. You know, it's like the same as Achterberg looking at the drawings, that we're always giving this exquisitely sensitive self these things, or we're yelling at our spleen or whatever. Now, another area where this comes into play that I think is absolutely crucial, and we all do it, I'm as guilty of it as anyone, and, you know, it is in the area of what we put into our body. And again, there's all this evidence that suggests that we can override all kinds of things. I mean, one of my favorite stories that I talk about in the book is Ram Dass, you know, who started his sort of spiritual quest by taking LSD, went to India sort of searching for the truth, as they say, and he came upon this yogi who said that he wanted to take some LSD, and so Ram Dass gave him a hit, and he said, no, give me all of the LSD you have. Ram Dass gives him a handful of LSD, and he pops in his mouth, swallows a handful of LSD. So Ram Dass is waiting for this guy to start, you know, unwrapping his turban and screaming and running, but the guy just continues throughout his day, placid as normal, no apparent effect. Every once in a while, he would just toss a sort of smile at Ram Dass, you know, just to show him. And it was pretty clear by the end of the day that this LSD had not had an effect on this yogi. Now, that's, you know, how is this possible? Well, again, we look at our own medical literature, our own scientific literature, we find all kinds of examples of this. There are studies, you know, where they've given the same as these lines on the wall, you know, that I talked about in the Solomon-Ash experiment, where people want to be part of the consensus. You give people, you can give, like, a person an amphetamine and put them in a group of people that they've given everyone else barbiturates. And the person on the amphetamine If they tell them that they're on a barbiturate, and if there are a room full of people who are all on barbiturates, they'll behave as if they're on a barbiturate. Just the reverse is true, too. You give a person a barbiturate, put them in a room full of people on amphetamines, tell them they've all taken the same thing, and they behave not as the drug, according to the drug that's in their body, but according to their belief system of how they should behave, and what, even more importantly, how the consensus is behaving. Because not only is it what you tell yourself, but that we really are, you know, hooked into each other. So much so, one of the most interesting placebo stories I think that I talk about in the book is a doctor has an asthma patient. He comes in, and the guy has really bad asthma. His lungs just freeze up. He can't breathe. And the doctor has a new asthma drug, and he gives him the new drug, and the guy's breathing is just great. And he goes home. Several days later, he comes back, and he goes, you know, that drug really worked really well, but now it's worn off. I need some more. And the doctor thought, well, I'm going to fool this guy. I'm going to give him a placebo and see if this works. So he gave him a placebo. The guy took it, and the guy went home, and an hour later, comes back, and he goes, I don't know what was wrong with that, but it's not working. I can't breathe. And the doctor thought, well, interesting, the drug must really work, because the placebo didn't. Well, then the drug company wrote the doctor and said, oh, we've done something awful. We sent you all placebos. So the guy got a placebo the first time as well, but the difference was that the doctor didn't know it. Not just the man, but the doctor didn't know it. So something implicit in the doctor's attitude to convey to this man, this placebo will work, this one won't. So, you know, again, Lord only knows what we're learning just in the attitude of the people around us. And you've got to always, you know, as I say, be vigilant over your own self and your own body. And there have been studies that have shown, for example, that drugs work better. You can take the same drug and put it in a different color capsule. First, if you give a drug in a pill or a capsule, the capsule always works better than the pill, because we have a sort of cultural conditioning that capsules contain more potent drugs than just pills or tablets. You give it the same drug in an injection, it works even better, because we have a cultural conditioning that only really heavy drugs go in injections. And even the color of the capsule of the pill will affect the activity of the drug. So, you know, you take the drug, and if it's a red pill, it'll work much better than if it's a pale yellow pill. And so all this stuff that we're completely unaware of, that we're constantly doing to ourselves, even more extraordinary, I mentioned, you know, multiple people with multiple personalities. It's been discovered that if you are performing surgery on a multiple, this multiple is under anesthesia, and another one of their personalities comes through while they're under anesthesia, they'll wake up on the operating table, and they won't be anesthetized. So therapists have to go in and say, okay, this personality has to stay under while that surgery is performed. And there are even instances of multiples, this is even more common, where multiple can get drunk. One personality can get drunk, and the other can drive home because the other's not drunk. And different drugs, like if a multiple switches personalities while they're on one drug, that's not affecting the other personality. Now, as I say, what does this mean? How can we, you know, again, as I always keep in mind, as I say, the exquisite sensitivity of the self. And what do we do? What are we doing with, like, the nutritional information? I mean, every day don't you hear about something else that's bad for you, you know? This is bad for you, that's bad for you. And so what do you do when you eat? You think, God, I shouldn't be eating this because this is bad for me. And now, knowing all this, what on earth are we doing to our bodies with all this terrible stuff, you know, that we're feeding our minds as well as our bodies? And there, again, you look at the medical literature, and there are things, you know, we're all taught, there are things that challenge us, just extraordinary challenges to this. We're all taught, you know, you don't eat a lot of eggs because that's going to raise your cholesterol, right? Well, it just came out in the literature, there's a fellow, he has an eating disorder, a psychopathology. He's got it through his head that he has to eat eggs to live. And so he's, for the last 15 years, he's eaten 25 soft-boiled eggs a day. That's almost 140,000 eggs over the course of the past 15 years. Well, the doctors, when they learned about this, they thought, well, this poor soul, he's going to be, you know, his arteries are going to be absolutely clogged. And they tested him. He has a lower than normal cholesterol. And I said, well, do you know your cholesterol is lower than normal? And he goes, well, yeah, what's cholesterol, you know? And they go, well, why do you eat these eggs? Well, I have to eat these eggs to live. These eggs are good for me. I have to eat eggs to live, because he's a nut, you know. But he avoided having all this cholesterol. And lo and behold, other cases like this are surfacing. There's a man, I just read another case about a man who eats mainly bacon fat. No cholesterol level. Now, what would happen to us if we ate nothing but bacon fat? You know our cholesterol would go through the ceiling, because we know that cholesterol raises, or that bacon fat raises the cholesterol level. Well, I don't believe that. I don't think it's better to be ignorant. I think it's better that we're in the middle ground between ignorance and enlightenment. You know, like the Neoplatonist, Plotinus said, man is poised halfway between the beast and the gods, and that's where we are, right there. I don't think it's better to be ignorant. It's far better to be beyond. And so what do you do? When you eat food, You know, there's a case came, another case about a woman who ate a very high-fat diet, lots of junk food, but she was a follower of Edgar Cayce. I'm sure most of you probably know the name Edgar Cayce. And one thing Edgar Cayce said is he said, always bless the food before you eat it. And so she always does. She goes, this food will only make me healthy, and she always blesses it. And she too has a normal cholesterol, you know, normal triglyceride, normal cholesterol level, all this thing. But what do most of us do when we eat? You know, most of us curse our food constantly. If you eat a candy bar, you go, well, this is going to mess me up, really. You know, I shouldn't be eating this donut. Now, I'm not advocating throw nutrition out the window. I'm just saying, you know, make nutritional choices. But if you're going to make the choice to eat something, for God's sakes, don't tell your body it's bad for you. You know, tell your body that it's only going to it's blessed and it's only going to be good for you. And of course, people, Siegel has said the same thing about chemotherapy. You know, he has people draw a picture of them receiving radiation or chemotherapy. Those that draw it as these death rays hitting them, he knows they're going to die. Those who draw it as a sort of golden light bathing them, he knows they're going to live. Because what are they telling the exquisitely sensitive self, the infinite self that is taking all this stuff in? You know, it's what you tell yourself that affects what's going on. And so if you're going to eat something, like, you know, what I do is I try to eat a healthy diet, but if I feel like eating a donut, I eat it. But I certainly don't say, oh, well, now I'm really good. You know, now I'm doing it to myself. I bless it. And, you know, Siegel and other doctors and you know, of this ilk have stories of people who have their chemotherapy that instead of, like, you know, even referring to it, like one woman took her chemotherapy and she wrote on a healing elixir because she decided, even the word, you know, just as the colors of the pills affect us, well, this woman had decided, even the word chemotherapy has this negative valence, you know, that you, if you're saying chemotherapy, we all know chemotherapy is deadly, you know. And there's an experiment I talk about in the book where they took a group of cancer patients in England, they divided them in half, they gave half chemotherapy, half a placebo, told everyone this is a really toxic drug, may cause you to lose your hair, and 30% of the people taking the placebo lost their hair. You know, what are we doing when we say these things to people? You know, and we know these things, but we don't incorporate them in our common wisdom. Your doctor doesn't say, oh, by the way, this drug may cause you to lose your hair, especially if you believe it does. He or she just says, this may cause you to lose your hair. Some slightly more enlightened don't tell you. They say, well, I'm not going to read you the bad side effects, but that's even more scary, yeah. You know. But the real attitude is, well, you know, studies show that people, this causes, this percentage of people lose their hair, but probably you wouldn't lose your hair if you believed it, you won't, you know. And in fact, there's one woman who went to Siegel, and he gave her this really toxic chemotherapy, and she was absolutely fine on it, no vomiting, no hair loss, no nothing. And he said, you're doing really well on this. And she said, well, you know, my friend told me that it would have no side effects. And her friend was a nurse and knew what she was doing. Said, this, you'll be fine. You'll be absolutely fine. The woman bought it. And so that's, I think, it's, in a way, that's still ignorance. But if you can go beyond that and become a little more conscious of it, I think it's even better. So, the key word is always be vigilant. What are you telling yourself? You know, look at all the aspects of your life. You know, whether you're looking in the mirror, what do you tell yourself? When you look at your body, what do you tell yourself? When you eat, what do you tell yourself? When you go to a doctor, what do you tell yourself? What are the directions you're giving your infinite self? When you set goals for your life, what are you telling yourself? Well, I could never do that. Or are you telling yourself, well, I can accomplish anything I want? You know, just always, you know, as I say, remember those words, be vigilant. And then remember, you know, the other thing that I think is crucial is remember that fear, your unconscious mind always takes fear as a direction. So be careful about fearing and, you know, be careful, make a judgment. And we don't, you know, it's kind of sad because I always liken human beings, we're like infants sitting at the control panel of jumbo jets because we have all these amazing capabilities and things, but we're just flicking switches out of ignorance. We don't know what, you know, how to work. And we're not taught. We're taught, our culture strives very hard to teach us what to think, but not how to think, you know. And it's far more important to teach how to think than what to think. And so another thing that I always tell people, and it's very important, is if you start to believe something, you know, it doesn't matter what the external reality says. If the external, you know, you, like, you, as I said, you know, if your evidence of your behavior suggests you have a bad memory, for God's sakes, don't then reinforce it by telling yourself you have a bad memory. And if you're doing something, ask the question, what is the payoff? You know, what will I get if I tell myself this? Like, I have a friend who his lover died of AIDS, and he had really been very attentive in the last several months of the fellow's life. Had taken him, you know, out of the hospital, let him die at home. And after he died, and I went and visited this friend, and he was very upset, and not only just through the normal grief process, but he said, you know, I just can't shake the feeling that I could have done something more. And I said, well, is there something that you think a specific thing, you think I should have done this and I didn't do it? He said, no, it just seems like I should have done something more. What's the payoff to thinking that thought? The payoff to thinking that you could have done something more is not that he had a logical reason for thinking that. He was just thinking, I could have done something more. And what was the payoff in that instance? It was pain. You know, so why run that sentence through your head? Because, what I just said is we were all taught what to think, but not how to think. And we're not taught that whenever we run a sentence through our head, we think that we're at the victim of the sentences that run through our head. We don't realize that we control. And, of course, that's we control which sentences. I call it controlling which tape you pop into the player, you know. And one thing, you know, if you start to run a sentence, I could have done something more, you've got to be vigilant. You've got to go, well, what's the payoff? In this instance, the payoff is pain. I'm not going to run that sentence. And sentences are addictive. I mean, that sentence is going to crop up again and again, but each time you say no to it, it's going to be like an alcoholic saying no to alcohol. Each time you say no and don't run the sentence through your head, it's going to become a little easier until finally you reach a point where you won't run that sentence anymore. And you can look at every area of your life. Are you feeling guilty about something? Are you worrying about something? You're feeling self-doubt, lack of self-esteem? Ask yourself the question, what's the payoff? And if you want the payoff, I mean, if you feel, you know, if the thought you're running through your mind is, I can accomplish anything, and you say, what's the payoff? Well, payoff may be able to allow me to accomplish anything. Then keep it. There are positive addictions as well as negative addictions. So become addicted to those thoughts that, you know, that you want in your life. But if the payoff, you don't want the payoff, then you got to get rid of the payoff. Or you got to get rid of the tape, get rid of the sentence. And I'm going to, it's about 4:30, which will leave us about 15 minutes for questions. I'm going to end on telling you something that sounds like a bit curious of a story to end on, but I think after you think about it for a moment, you'll realize why I'm ending it on a story. And it sounds curious at first blush because it's about bats. And but in it, I think it's such an important lesson that I frequently end talks with this story. I was reading a book about bats a while back, and I read a very interesting thing. It was discovered, you know, bats, as you know, operate according to sonar, and they can see in the dark. They don't have to have light to see. They can fly through caves with all these obstacles, and they can fly effortlessly. What was discovered, one cave where they were studying bats, they put a door in the cave, and all of a sudden all the bats started bashing in the door and dying. And I thought, well, how can this be happening? They have sonar. Why aren't they seeing this door? And reports of this kept coming in that they set up some equipment in another cave and bats started flying into it. And they said, well, how is this happening? Finally, they performed some studies and they found out why it was happening. And that is, they took a very large room and they filled it full of obstacles and they flew a bat through it. And the bat flew through effortlessly. It used its sonar to navigate around everything. Well, they flew the bat through about 20, 30 times, and each time the bat did it effortlessly. Then they moved the stuff around, and that's when the bat started hitting stuff. And so they thought, well, this is interesting. It took a while the bat to learn to fly around it again. What was happening is that the bat used sonar the first several times it did something, but then it started using just memory, so that it got so used to flying, knowing where the obstacles were, that it flew around them. And in fact, it was so accustomed to flying around them that even when they completely emptied the room, after it learned to follow this very circuitous course, it would continue to fly that circuitous course through. Well, in this, so they completely emptied the room after they taught the bats how to fly. And here they are, still flying around every obstacle that they thought was in there. And when I read that, I thought, well, that's the perfect metaphor for what we do in our life. Because what do? We learn that there's an obstacle. We learn there's something we can't do, or there's something that'll affect us adversely. And from that point on, we fly around it. Maybe there was a good reason to believe it was there in the first place. Maybe it was actually an obstacle there. But then we stop using our sonar, in essence, and we only use our memory, and we continue to fly around all the obstacles that we think are still there. And that's part of, you know, being vigilant and asking what's the payoff. Every day in my life, it seems, I find myself, and as I say, you've got to be vigilant. You can't just think. You've got to think about thinking. You know, if I find myself planning to do something, and then I go, well, no, I can't do that. Then I go, well, why am I thinking I can't do that? And sometimes there's a good reason why I can't do it. But sometimes there's an irrational reason why I can't do it, and that irrational reason is I'm flying around an invisible obstacle. I'll find, well, I can't do that because my parents never did that, and I learned that you just never do that. But now in my life, I want to do this. So you have to always use your sonar. Don't rely just on the memories of the past that are teaching you all these, as I say, these, you know, invisible obstacles like this rest exercise. And always make sure, because most of us follow this circuitous path through life around what we think are obstacles, but really, like, you know, the bats in this experiment, we have this wide range of area where we could be forging entirely new paths for ourselves if we weren't so controlled by our habits and you know, our beliefs and all these things that we think we're constructing there. And those are the words that I want to close on. And now, if any of you have any questions.
I have a question regarding when your unconsciousness, can that pertain to, like, can your unconscious mind grab the energy outside your body, like maybe dreaming, but it's not dreaming? Do you know what I mean?
I don't quite know what you mean yet.
Okay, well, I just had an experience. This was years ago. And I was awake. Now, I know I was awake. People are telling me, oh, you're dreaming. You know, there are things that you're dreaming with your eyes open. But I'm like, how can that be? I was sore. You know, my what they said, it was...
Is it possible? Is the experience too personal, or can you tell me what the experience was?
No, it was only like I was in high school. It was years ago. And and what it was, I remember one night I was with a friend. I was staying at a friend's house. And I love horses. I just absolutely love horses. And we had a model. It was a black stallion, the model. And it was a full moon. And where I was sleeping, the window was open, and you could see the bright moon, the moonbeam or whatever. It was very bright, and it just shone in the room, in the light. It was very bright, and it shone on the model, the horse. And I just kept thinking of, you know, the model. I'm just like, oh, I love that model. I love horses. Well, I went, what I thought I was asleep, but I had my eyes awake. I was wide awake. All of a sudden, I just see the room around, surrounded by horses, and I'm running with them, and we just kept running. It was dark, though, and I kept looking, and I still saw the model, I still saw the moon shining, yet the room, what with the wall, was, you know, what is it, like the wilderness or something, you know, with all the horses and everything, and then suddenly it just disappeared, and I saw my friend next to me. And I'm just like, what's going on, you know? And I'm just like, I must be dreaming or something. And I'm just, you know, I was like this time instead of lying down. And so I was like this, and I just kept staring. And right next to me, my friend happened to be a blonde, but right next to me happened just like that. Just like she's right there. I was like this, and all of a sudden I'm seeing a Belgian horse. It looks like a Clydesdale. And it had golden hair. And I'm petting it. You know, I'm just like, whoa, you know. And then all of a sudden, I'm just walking, and then I'm running. And then I come back, and then the Belgian's next to me, and I'm petting it, because then I have the other two horses next to me. And I'm petting it, and all of a sudden, it just goes away. My friend's looking at me like, what the hell are you doing? You're petting me. You know, I'm just like, I'm sorry. And she's like, out of the small, and I'm just like, she's like, you're dreaming. I'm like, no, I'm not. I've had my eyes open, you know. So I'm just like, fine, you know. So I kept staring. The moon was still, it was still bright. It's just like I sensed something. And then I just, this time I was in a position like this with my eyes open. And then all I saw was like black and the stars. I was in the wilderness again. But I think this time I was the one who was the horse, you know. And then it just transformed into that I was riding a horse. And I did bareback riding a lot, you know, and then that morning I just finally woke up and I was just very sore. My friend's like, you're weird. And I was just like, no, I'm not. This happened, you know. And I maybe spoke to one other person, two other people, that one person did believe me, and another person's like, you're dreaming. It's, you know, your mind is tricking you or something. So I don't know.
Well, let me make a comment on that. There's something that I also talk about in the book. The 12th century Persian Sufis had a very interesting take on things like this, because they said, first of all, they said that the imagination was as much of a sense as our sight, our hearing. Now, we in our Western culture say the imagination is less real than reality. Two things. One, if the extreme point of view in the holographic idea is correct, the imagination is as real as objects, just to a different degree, maybe like on a different channel in the cosmic television set. But the Sufis said that if you practice what they called creative prayer, you could create realities out of this imagination. And there was a Sufi, a scholar of the Sufis, a contemporary academic named Henri Corbin, who wrote quite a few books, and I quote his work in the book. And he came, there was this word in Persian that they kept using that a lot of scholars had translated as imaginary, but he knew that it wasn't the same word as what the Sufis said when they used the word imaginary. And so he coined the term imaginal, because what the Sufis are saying is that when you imagine something, you can create things out of the imagination, but they're not imaginary, they're real, but they are created by the imagination. And so he coined the term imaginal to differentiate, to say they're not imaginary. And I talk quite an extent in the book on imaginal things, that there are these sort of degrees of, if the universe is a hologram, there are these degrees of reality where we probably do have to expand our definition of imaginary and imagination and include a third term like imaginal. And it sounds, well, it's like me seeing heaven. You were a challenge, said you can't be doing this, and so you stopped it. You know, you shut it down.
Yeah, the way you're using the word imagination is like the way the poet William Blake uses it as a sort of synonym for the creative capacity in human beings. But I had a comment and a question. This has, I guess, nothing to do with your topic, but you were talking about Jansenism, and to set it in its historical context, it's interesting to notice it actually eventually won, at least in American Catholicism. It became the prevailing strain in American Catholicism, at least until Vatican II. And probably people that grew up in the church, they never heard the word Jansenism, but they're very familiar with what it's like, that very legalistic approach, and, you know, and don't need, you know, if you even think about something bad, you're going to go to hell and all that. That's Jansenism. My question is, can we do it the opposite way? Can we eradicate our belief systems so we can actually see the world the way it really is? I know a lot of New Agers say you create your own reality, so the world isn't really any way. It's just whatever way you make it. But that seems sort of trivial. That makes kind of like our highest aspirations are just sort of whimsies or something. But could we use this power you're talking about to destroy our belief systems and just to see the world the way it is?
Well, I don't think so. I see. The way that you talk, it's clear to me that you consider, you know, when you say that it's a kind of whimsy, to me, that's the most liberating thing that there is. Because your question presupposes that there is a world the way it really is. That there's one reality out there that if we could drop our belief systems, we could tie into that one reality. And that, of course, is a very pervasive belief in Western thinking. I personally don't believe it's true. I don't think there's a reality out there. I think that is a metaphysical assumption. And, you know, I mean, I talk about this in the book. There are instances, there's a Charles Tart, the parapsychologist who spoke and gave a workshop here, did an experiment once in something he called mutual hypnosis, where he took two people who were talented hypnotic subjects and talented hypnotists, and he had them hypnotize each other. And when they did that, they entered a reality that was completely of their own making. And they started experiencing a reality that he was not privy to. And not only that, they thought they were talking in their reality, but he kept saying, what do you see? And they were frustrated because they thought they were talking, but really they were so connected in this reality that in their reality they were talking, but in this reality they were being silent. And, if we have evidence of this, like another thing, a lot of people go, well, maybe the Jansenist miracles never happened. Maybe it was mass hypnosis. But, you know, for God's sakes, what is mass hypnosis? If 8,000 people can see the same thing, how can we decide, you know, what criteria do we decide? The only criteria we have to decide what is real is when everyone sees it. You know, if we start saying there's a category of things that is not real, even though everyone sees it, then that is metaphysical, because you're kind of making an aesthetic value judgment here about what is real and what isn't. But, you know, the fact that Tarte's two subjects could create this amazing reality, I believe, and I know it's a controversial belief and a radical belief, because I don't believe there is a reality out there. I think all we have is the agreement, the consensus, that we're all is sort of connected into this mutual hypnosis. And I think it's very interesting, because one of the things that's always said about the hypnotic state, you know, if a person's dreaming, they have all these physiological readings you can take that's different from the waking state. If a person, you know, all different altered states have different physiological environments that you can measure in the body. But the one state that doesn't have any abnormal readings is hypnosis. The state, in fact, the state when a person is hypnotized, if you measure their heart rate, everything about them, their brain waves, everything, it's identical to the waking state. And everyone goes, well, maybe hypnosis doesn't exist. Well, I think probably quite the opposite is true. Probably hypnosis is exists. It's just that we're all hypnotized always, because hypnosis is the normal state. And so, you know, I come from a different, it's my prejudice. I fully admit that it's a bias that I don't believe there is a reality beyond that which we create. And I don't find that diminishing. I find that the most liberating. I'm always reminded of the Argentinian short story writer Jorge Luis Borges. He wrote a story called Plan Ucbar Orbis Tertius. And in it, there was a mythical society called Plan. And the Tlanians discovered, they were searching for truth, and they discovered eventually that there was no truth, that all truth was created. And Borges says in the story that one would expect for their science to have ground to a halt at that point, but exactly the opposite occurred. Once they realized there was no truth to discover, their science cranked up all the more, because then they were sort of liberated and realized they could create whatever they wanted. And I feel like the Tlanians, I think that's, you know, that's, it is liberating, not frightening for me, but it's a personal aesthetic. Some people want there to be a reality out there, and that's, I think, I mean, in the book, I do some sort of wild speculation, because I think that when you believe in a reality out there, I think the reason that we live in a reality that seems so to be such a solid construct and so much of a consensus reality is because we are not ready yet to deal with a totally self-created reality. We'd quickly become terrified in a totally self-created reality. And I liken it to children who haven't learned to color without having lines to color in. We still need the coloring book of reality, because if we had a completely plastic reality, it would be like the worst acid trip that anyone's been on, you know? And I think that's why we're in this physical reality. That's why we're where we're at in life, is we're learning slowly what our abilities are. We're learning to stretch our sort of imaginal legs, if you will, so that we will eventually get to a point where we can deal with a far more plastic reality without going off on a bad acid trip while doing it, or without, you know, it's like if you look at shamanic traditions too, it's the same thing, that the big lesson that the shaman has to go through is that when they go through the underworld and they go through all these demons and you know, the fires of hell, that the lesson they have to learn is that they're not real unless they believe they are, that they're all self-projections, that everything that exists in those shamanic landscapes is exactly real, it's absolutely real, but it's also self-created. The Tibetans, there's a type of Tibetan called Vajrayana, where the Tibetans create thought forms. They focus on some image, and they're atheists, which I find absolutely fascinating, because they have all these deities, but they're atheists. And what they do is they take a deity and they do what's called a rite of visualization, so they keep visualizing it as real until they can see it, like you saw your horses. And they see it as real, and they say if you keep doing it, if you keep imbuing it with energy, you'll reach a point where not only will other people start to see, also start to see it, but it'll eventually start to talk and perform miracles, this self-created projection. And once a yogi has reached a point where they can do this, where they can create a thought form, they call them tulpas, they have to go through a sort of rite of passage. It's called the Dreadful Mystic Banquet, or the Dance of Chod. And what they do is they have to go to a place that's very psychologically frightening for them, like a cemetery or a cliff. And they project a horde of thought form demons, and they also project a double of themselves. And they watch the demon rip themselves limb from limb and devour it. And the point of the practice is that all the while, no matter how horrific and real that scene seems, they're supposed to always experience no fear and always know that it's completely self-created. And it's said that if they experience fear and start to worry that these things are real and they're in danger, that they'll be found ripped limb from limb the next morning. But if they don't experience fear, then they've earned the right to create these projections. And I think in essence, we're all sort of heading toward our own dance of Chod. We're slowly learning about that we're creating projections, and we're not there yet. We're not, you know, it's terrifying to us to think that there are no boundaries or limits, that there may be no comforting solid reality out there. I'm just giving you my opinion. I could certainly be wrong, but I don't think there is.
You've mentioned that you've had a range of psychic experiences, and you've also you've mentioned the power of beliefs for healing. Would you extend what you've said to other psychic phenomena and also if there are techniques for experiencing them that can be taught?
Well, it's a vast subject. I'll just give you a very quick example. I think that they most definitely can be taught. One of the things, though, is, again, you know, it gets back to what I was talking about in the talk, is that we have this limited self, and then we have this infinite self, and the consciousness believes in limits. And you have to bypass the consciousness. And it's interesting to me, there have been lots of different groups that do this, like the Stanford Research Institute group did an experiment where they tried to get people to predict what would happen, precognitively predict what would happen to copper futures. Well, they discovered, they said to them, okay, is copper the price? There are three possibilities. The price of copper will go up, it'll go down, it'll stay the same. Now they said, is the price of copper going to go up tomorrow? Intellectually, they'd start to think, well, there's the Gulf crisis going on, there's this, there's that, and they could do no better than chance. But when they started to get accurate is when they said, okay, let's forget about copper. And what they did is they attached a symbol to each of the possibilities. They said, if the price of copper goes up, they didn't tell their test subjects this. They just said, if the price of copper goes up, it'll be a banana. If it goes down, it'll be an apple. If it stays the same, it'll be a grape. And then what they do to the person, they go, tomorrow I'm going to hand you a piece of fruit. What's the piece of fruit that you see me handing you? Well, the person didn't know what the pieces of fruit represented. But because they couldn't figure out, well, it's the Gulf crisis, so it'll be a grape, because that was no longer meaningful, they go, oh, well, I see you handing me a grape. And that's when they started predicting. Now, the point is, what they had to do there is they had to bypass the intellect, because the intellect gets in the way of the infinite self that knows all this stuff. And they also did this when they were doing remote viewing and having people, because if they gave people latitudes and longitudes and said, what is in the world at this latitude and longitude? Can you describe what's there? People started going, running through their head intellectually what the latitude and longitude was. So what they did to bypass it is they converted latitude and longitude into binary numbers, which most people can't decipher. It's just a meaningless series of numbers. And they go, here's a meaningless series of numbers that represents a latitude and longitude. What's there? Then people could do it. So as I say, it's a complex subject. I could talk for hours on that subject alone, but that's just one example where, again, it involves tricking the infinite self. You're tricking the conscious self, so that the intellectual self, so you can bypass it. Because the intellect believes in limits and doesn't think it can do these things and tries to reason things out. And I'm not saying that, I mean, reason has a role, it's just not all of who and what we are. It's just one part of the vastness that we call self. And there's another part that already knows all this stuff, and it's this, the knack is to get down into that part to access it. The fellow in the back of the room?
You keep referring to the book. Which book are you referring to?
Okay. What a good question.
Holographic Universe?
Yeah, I've got, you can come up if you want. I've got some, a flyer here on the Holographic Universe. They're selling it in the bookstore, and also a flyer on another book I did called Beyond the Quantum, so you can help yourself to those.
What's your reference on the Tibetan examples you gave? Any books?
The tulpas? There's a book by Alexander David Neal, Magic and Mystery in Tibet. There's a book by John Blofeld called Tantric Mysticism in Tibet. Those are two books that'll talk about that.
Say that all again.
Madam Alexandra David Neal. David Neal is hyphenated. I think it's N-E-E-L.
Yes.
Magic and Mystery in Tibet. She talks about the Dance of Chod in there. And John Blofeld, B-L-O-F-E-L-D, the Tantric Mysticism of Tibet.
My question is addressed to the part where you said it's underneath the source that the infinite comes from. I think you just said, I can't remember your wording because I was thinking about my question, but I'm not going to word it. But I've had two experiences that I think you could explain that I'm curious about. One of them is that I'm a homeopath, and some of my clients will say that I appear to them at night and work on them. I have no connection with that, no desire, no awareness, but that happens. The other thing addresses when you were talking about consensus reality, where one time I thought I'd given my client sepia, and I'd actually given them sulfur.
and they react entirely differently in the body. But I believe I was giving sepia, and I said, well, you will experience that or that. And they did. And it blew my mind when I went to write up at the end of the day in their chart what I had given them. I went, it's not possible. I gave them something. Oh, my God. Now they're going to have that or that. They had had sepia results until
you changed your mind.
Yeah. So what's going on there?
Well,
well,
you know, the holographic idea says that we're all completely interconnected, and I think, I mean, I talk about this to a great extent in the book. Of all, there are all kinds of studies like that. You can take, you know, put people in separate rooms and hook one up to an electroencephalograph and put flash a strobe light in the other person's eyes, and you can say to the person hooked up to the electroencephalograph, tell me when the light is flashing in the other person's eyes. And consciously they can't do it, but in their brainwave patterns people can register when it's flashing, and you can do all kinds of physiological measurements that show this tremendous interconnectedness that exists between people. I mean, not the least of which is this remote viewing. I mean, they're very controversial results, of course, but there are results in hypnosis that I talk about here where hypnotists have taken and they put, you know, a hypnotist can put salt in his mouth and tell a person that they've hypnotized that they're tasting something, that they've just put something in their mouth. What does it taste like? And the person that, you know, doesn't have the salt in their mouth will say it's salt. They'll taste what the hypnotist is tasting. And, I mean, example after example of interconnectedness. And I think we are, and whether the holographic idea is correct or not. In fact, I should just say I don't think any system or theory is truth. I think it's just a tool. And the holographic idea, for me, it's not that it's the absolute truth. It's that it's a very useful tool for understanding to a certain mindset, I think especially the Western mindset, because we want things in a sort of part and parcel way, that it's a way of understanding. So I don't mean to at all to suggest that I think it's gospel. As I say, it's just one way of looking at the universe that has certain uses. Did you have something quick to add? Or?
Yeah. Are you finished?
No, no.
Oh, sorry. About the consensus reality, then, so it is completely, I mean, it's, what level? It's so deep. I mean, that.
Well, I think everything in that, you know, it's what creates reality. As I said, you know, and as I say, I could be wrong. This is just my bias, but I don't think there is a reality except that which we make. And the reason that we can make it consensus is because we are connecting at such a deeply unconscious level to create the consensus. That, you know, we're all at a deeply unconscious level participating in the creation of this mass dream. And so,
any conscious awareness, and so therefore,
yeah, we can learn to become conscious of it, but we're not. That's not where we're at. And about you manifesting, you know, to your patients, there's again, as I say, this is just my bias, but I believe, and I have experiences like this also, and there's quite a tradition to it in the literature that, and I think that suggests that we are. So that I think during our sleep we soul travel all the time, that we're always doing stuff, that the infinite self is, that you may be functioning as a teacher at an unconscious level, doing teaching grand and amazing things that consciously you don't even know, and you're assisting with other people. And I mean, I have a file, because in the book, one of the things that I'm interested in, I'm sort of researching now, is people who have dreams of attending school at night. And I don't mean just anxiety dreams of going naked to high school. I mean attending schools on other levels of reality. And letters have been pouring in about people saying, well, I had this experience and I had that experience. Because I think a good deal, as I said, we're iceberg beings. I think a good deal of our life does take place below the surface of our consciousness. Our soul is vast and multidimensional. It's all doing all kinds of stuff all the time that we don't consciously know about. We have 1 minute, so quick.
I wonder what it is in us that determines whether something is real or a dream, because I had an experience in meditation once where I came out of the meditation and my experience was that this reality was a dream, and then that experience in the meditation was absolutely real. And this experience happened to me 15 years ago, and I still wonder if that person that I experienced then is just having this dream.
Yeah, Carol, you take that one.
In my experience, The experience of the plane was a little bit more in-depth than what Michael said, but it's in the book. Because I talked directly to his plane, and his plane told me, and listen, I'm not going to get it, because this guy keeps cussing me out. So he asked me if I could please do a little healing. I said, I can't do any healing, but I can ask your organs what the problem is. And he said, listen, this is what it's like. Now, what was it that was talking to me? It was the spirit of his plane. And what was talking to you is that this is not real. It's the spirit of you, which is the infinite part of us, which never changes and can never be destroyed, and it's in our heart. It moves in and out of our bodies through our breath. And so when you are breathing, you're certainly breathing when you're sleeping, you were contacting your patient. Your spirit was with every breath you took and then you took home and have no limitations and no boundaries. So time and space do not exist. But a focus on a patient does. So you're there and you're telling them what they need. And then you got, oh God, and all your systems then shut down. Which Michael and I have had very many discussions over the last 6 years together about what you mean by how this works. Because being a person that always labels very illumined spirit and wondered what the heck was wrong with everybody else. And everybody said, when did you realize you were psychic? And I said, I never realized I was. I realized other people weren't. And I spent the rest of my life trying to figure out ways to cope with a world that wasn't like the world that I always saw, always dreamed in, and I never slept. Because my spirit was always awake. So if you have children that are insomniac, it's because their spirit is always awake. And not disturb them and don't distress them. Because they will go to sleep eventually. You get very bored with physical reality and finally go to sleep. So you get back in your level of spirit. We always live very happily ever after. And it's going to mean George Bush doesn't exist.
Sure. What's your name?
My name is Nina Talbot.
Oh, goodness, really? Let me use this pen.
Oh, great. Thank you. Also, I appreciate your work so much more than I can say.
Thank you. I'm all out.
Okay, I sort of like to keep in touch, so sometimes I don't have to.
Michael, I'm with the expo. Are you going to the bookstore to do a signing, or did you just come here?
Should I go to the bookstore?
Did you plan it beforehand?
No.
Okay. It's set up there to do it if you want to. I mean, these people got the bookstore.
Well, I'll be happy to do it. Why don't we? Because you need the room, right? You need to clear up the room.
No, not really. It's 30 minutes.